How has your relationship with the violin and with music mutated, changed, grown, whatever? Has it ever seemed like work playing the violin? Where there's nothing wrong with work.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, we're like an athlete. You know, when an athlete is flying through the air, there's a rush and an exhilaration that many people never get to experience. But an athlete is training hour after hour after hour. And to be a master artist, international violinist, you're like a samurai. You're like an athlete. And so there's a tremendous amount of work that continues. My wife, when we were starting to date, I remember she came to hear me perform as a soloist at the Hollywood Bowl in front of 12,000 people. And she heard me play the Tchaikovsky Concerto. After we were married, she was on tour with me, where I think it was Mexico City, and I was scheduled to play the Tchaikovsky Concerto, and she saw me in my hotel room practicing. And she had never been exposed to musicians before, and she said, "Well, Danny, why are you practicing the Tchaikovsky? I thought you knew the piece." And so she had no idea that it's constant practice. So there is a tremendous work. Even Yasha Heifetz used to say it's 90% work and 10% talent. But you have to have that 10%.
That 10% is weighted perhaps more important. I'm interested about maintaining. I'm getting to the age where the aches and pains are setting in, and my goal is to work at, invest in my own physical health so that I can do what I want to do when I'm 90. I'm interested in how that works as a musician. And I'm also interested in whether you have to take special care of your hands.
I've never worried about insuring my hands or taking special care. I'm also a skier, and my manager would have heart attacks when I went skiing, but I would always ski more carefully. I wouldn't go under these super advanced slopes, even though I'm a good skier. And I love riding horses. But in terms of my hands, if I get near a dog, I put my hands in my pockets.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very aware of being careful in the kitchen. And I don't like to feel my hands greasy. That's a little pet peeve of mine. So in that way, I'm aware of where my hands. But other than that, I don't pay attention. It's important to be exercising. It's also important to understand how your body is changed because of playing the violin. Because you're standing in a certain position, it affects your hips, it affects your shoulders.
Wow.
There are some muscles in my body that are highly developed that other people's don't. In my elbows, in my shoulders, in my fingers, in my hand. So there are other areas where you are overuse. You have to be careful about tendonitis. The vibrato, shaking your hand while you're playing, is a constant moving of the wrist. So there are things you have to be careful about. I'm involved in exercising and weightlifting, and I'm very careful how I do that. It's important to stretch. It's important to do all those things in order to allow your body to function as an artist. But I had a difficult thing happen to me, though, because I've now formally retired from actually performing. I perform maybe once during the Institute because I was on stage in 1989 and my little finger fell off my violin and I almost dropped my bow on my right hand. And to make a long story short, I had my ulnar nerves were being compressed in my elbows. And your ulnar nerve controls your fourth and fifth fingers on each hand. And I went in for emergency surgery because I did nerve conduction tests where they would zap me in my neck and time how long the nerve impulses would go to my fingertips. They discovered that 60% of the nerve impulses were being blocked at both of my elbows.
Wow.
So I went in for emergency surgery on both of my elbows in 89, and the doctor discovered that your funny bone, which is the groove, your funny bone's your ulnar nerve, and you have a groove in your elbow where when you bend your elbow, the nerve recedes into that so-called funny bone. Well, the doctor discovered that my ulnar nerves, which are supposed to be white and the width of a small pencil, were both the width of a thread in Fire Engine Red. He discovered that the groove in my elbows, I was born with a defect where my grooves were too shallow. So the doctor in the operating room, because I was under a local anesthetic, said, "Mr. Heifetz, Your grooves in your elbows are too shallow. Every time you've bent your arm, you've compressed your ulnar nerve. How have you been able to play the violin? You've never had the full use of your hands. And this was after performing all over the world, winning my competitions, practicing 8 hours a day. I was told that I've never had the full use of my hands.
I'm gaping.
It was, as you can imagine, a shock. I had this schizophrenic reaction in the operating room. I started to cry, thinking about the 8 hours a day, the work, the constant everyday practicing. Yeah. And then I started to laugh. Said, "My God, look what I accomplished without the full use of my hands." And so he took my ulnar nerves out of my elbow, out of the bone, and laid them on the inside of my arm so that when I would bend my arm, they would have slack instead of being stretched over my shallow groove. That was fine, except that from 30 years, 40 years of compression, I have permanent nerve damage. So I've never lost some degree of numbness in my little fingers, which for somebody who has mastery of the instrument to have one clumsy finger, it really is very difficult. So I'm still able to play. I can still play actually better than I've ever played, but I can't sustain it. I can't do enough practicing to go on tour and to play the things that I used to play. So that's why I'll get back into shape and I'll maybe perform once during the Institute. But I formally retired from the concert stage around 2001. What happened then throughout the 90s is that, and this also plays into the Institute that I created, is that I redefined what I would do on stage. See, I could still perform. I could still play. So I stopped doing the more acrobatic things, and I started thinking, well, let's use more of my personality. Let's redefine the concert experience. And so I put together a string quartet with cello, with double bass and piano harpsichord, and I created concerts called Heifetz with the Classical Band. And we started doing concerts where I realized, why play all the movements of a piece when the composer was only inspired with two of the movements? Let's play the things that are the greatest, what the audiences love the most. And how about creating concerts that have themes? So I created a Vivaldi Four Seasons concert, but the audience doesn't know that Vivaldi wrote the poems, that this was the beginning of program music. And in the score, he wrote the different words that define the images that he was doing with the music. So here it was the drunken peasant, and here the birds were chirping, and here the dog was barking. And so I would play all those examples for the audience and then read the poem that Vivaldi wrote and then play the season. And it was as if the people heard this for the first time. So very exciting. And then I played a concert of all music that related to dance. I invited a great opera singer to join me on stage, and we did the Vivaldi.
Who was that?
Her name was Carmen Balthrop. She originated the role of Treemonisha, the Scott Joplin opera on Broadway and at the Metropolitan Opera. And so we did the Vivaldi concerto for two violins, and she sang the second violin part in scat. So we did all these creative things. It was really exciting.
Were you making lemonade doing this?
Yes, it was tremendously successful.
But I mean, in terms of in your head, were you saying, "Oh, I wish I could just play what I want to play, but I can't. So now I'm going to do this other stuff."
Yes, I had to be. You know, Martha, one of the guiding principles in life is flexibility. You know, life throws you curveballs, and so instead of becoming bitter and frustrated, you think, okay, now where can I direct my creative energies? Where can I use more aspects of my persona instead of just playing the violin concerto? And that's why I created these concerts. And it was very exciting. We did so many different things. But my fingers were getting more, the numbness was getting worse the more I was playing. And then at the same time, I decided, I've always been teaching, and I decided in my own teaching, one-on-one, I would pull the charisma out of a student.
When I listen to you being flexible throughout your life, I go back to you being raised by these sound like marvelous parents.
Pretty extraordinary.
In Beverly Hills, yeah, with your feet
on the ground.
On the ground. Do you trace? I mean,
oh, it's my parents. You know, it's the intensity of my father who taught us such self confidence. For example, I don't have a college degree. I went to conservatory, practiced 8 hours a day, and started playing concerts. But my father taught me to believe in yourself and to trust your own logic. And he said, Danny, if you follow a logic premise, you can have a debate with a Nobel Prize winner. And that gave me the confidence, as you can imagine, the people I've met throughout my life. I've always been comfortable with any person that I would meet and anyone I would talk to. My mother was the energy, the personality, was the charisma in the family. And I can just say the results. My younger brother, Ronald Heifetz, is the founder of the Center for Leadership at the Kennedy School of Government. He's a cellist, and the leadership, he counsels presidents and prime ministers. And my older brother created the prototype of a cancer center in Lake Tahoe, which is a prototype for rural cancer centers throughout the country. And it's all because we grew up with the idea that being flexible and having a healthy disrespect for authority. So when authorities would tell me,
right on,
you cannot teach charisma, my reaction is, sure you can, nobody's figured it out yet how to do it. And so that those are the things inside my head that enabled me to experiment and to propose the concept that you could create a curriculum that can open people up to really communicate what's deep inside and to project that communication outward. Can you change in classical music what unfortunately has happened too often? Intellectual, beautiful playing that does not really project the emotion over the footlights. And so,
you mean, by emotion, you mean, I'm sure,
the emotion of the composer connected to the emotion of the artist. I videotape that opening evaluation. They go through my training program, the Institute's training program now, and no one's allowed to perform without speaking to the audience. We videotape every concert. At the end of the 6 weeks, I redo the same audition. Now I stop the kid after 3 minutes. I say, sing the piece. Ba-da-dee-da-da, they sing without the inhibitions. I say, now tell me, what are you expressing? And they have so many ideas. I finally have to say, okay, enough already. And then the crucial question, play a 2-octave ascending scale communicating joy and happiness. And they finally understand, Martha, the magic is the breath before the first note and sustaining that energy no matter what notes you're playing. And the ones, and the transformation is astounding. To see the opening evaluation and the closing evaluation is incredible.
And are you?
And we videotape both, and we send every student a videotape of his transformation before and after.
While they are undergoing this, are they also practicing?
Oh, they're practicing 5 hours a day.
Okay.
They have two lessons a week. They're in chamber music. They have chamber music coachings. My faculty are some of the world's greatest artists who perform in Carnegie Hall all over the world.
List.
Yeah. I mean, we brought Carnegie Hall to Stanton, Virginia. And so it's the excellence just permeates everything that they're doing. And but the most exciting thing is that ability to the fact that they are transformed as communicative artists.
The Institute has been going on.
This next summer will be our 18th year.
Yes, I was thinking about 20 years.
But I kept it quiet for the first 8 or 9 years.
I was going to say, who let you do this?
My wife and I did it all on our own. At the beginning, I did all the teaching, I did all the performing, and experimented with the communication training. I would hire and fire teachers as I was working out the model.
Okay.
So because I don't believe in doing anything superficially, I did not want to let the world know about it until I felt I had perfected the model. And so after, you know, eight or nine years, I felt this was really happening. And that's when I let the word out. And in these past 10 years, it's become one of the major places in the world.
What happened when you, what was the reception when you, or the response when you first let the word out? You're really swimming upstream here.
I've had some pushback. For example, I don't allow any string quartets to sit down and play. I find that boring. I want to see their whole bodies engaged. So at the Heifetz Institute, all string quartets, all ensembles stand and play, and the cellist is put on a platform. Many colleagues, some refuse to do it. They say, I've been doing that for 50 years, sitting down and playing. I said, yeah, and that's why audience have stopped coming to the concerts.
We have to stand up during fundraisers for
right.
the same reason, so we have
right.
some energy.
Exactly. So colleagues who won't stand up, I don't rehire. So it's been that. I don't allow any students to use music on stage when they play a sonata. Because a violin piano sonata or a cello piano sonata is chamber music, two equal partners, but there's nothing more boring than seeing somebody standing on stage with their head in the music, and the music stand being a barrier between the artist and the audience. So I make the students memorize their sonatas. Basically, they don't want to because it's laziness, because they'd have to practice a sonata as hard as they practice a concerto, but they do it. And for once in their life, they experience the purity of that communication. The audience should feel that the music is coming out of you spontaneously, that you're creating it, not that you're putting on your glasses and reading it from the notes on the page.
And
very
so
important.
You are creating it.
Yeah.
Essentially,
so
you are creating that performance.
Exactly. It's so we're very unorthodox, but the truth is that the music world is really taking notice, and my colleagues are very supportive. They turn down incredible music festivals all over the world to come to the Heifetz Institute because they believe in this vision, and it's been the most heartwarming thing. The head of music and opera for the National Endowment for the Arts came this summer to the Institute. They've been supporting us for years. He said to our board that this is one of the most important things happening in the music world today, because we're the only place that's teaching the communication of the excellence rather than just creating the excellence.
What are you doing in Stanton?
What am I doing in Stanton?
What are you doing in
Stanton?
Well,
we outgrew our facility in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked all over the country. I was even offered a castle in France, you know, and I looked all over the country. Where would be the place to really make our permanent home? And I discovered Stanton.
What were you looking for? What were the criteria?
Looking for a campus that really understood who we are, that really would really welcome us and believed in the vision of the Institute. A town that had charm, a place where my famous colleagues would enjoy spending weeks on in the summer, and a place that had recreational potential. So when I came to Stanton and met with Pamela Fox, the president of Mary Baldwin College, I was overwhelmed because she is a visionary. She's the reason why we came here. She's also a pianist, understands music and art, and totally sees the importance of what we're doing in teaching communication. And she also sees how this goes beyond just music, because this communication curriculum can be taught to, it should be in the schools. It should be taught to public schools teachers who are basically doing the same thing in front of a class that we do in front of an audience. How to communicate, how to inspire, how to project your feelings and your emotions, and how to be able to hear what's going on between you and the audience. So one thing that's not being taught in schools is how to communicate. So Pamela Fox really understood and welcomed us and invited us in a beautiful way. Then we and Stanton. I can't imagine a more historic and charming and town of such character. And then the town welcomed us, the mayor and the city managers, from Bill Hamilton from Economic Development to Mayor Lacey, everybody involved, they just felt this could be absolutely wonderful for the city of Stanton. The American Shakespeare Center. The fact that you have one of the world's greatest Shakespeare centers here with the Blackfriars Theater, the only replica of Shakespeare's indoor theater, the whole combination was incredible. That this can become a international cultural center in the summer with music and drama. It has the potential for being something truly amazing. And all the organizations involved, we're so excited that we could come here that I made a presentation to our board of directors, and they agreed. They came down here, and they fell in love with it. So we consider this our permanent home. We could not be more excited.
Well, hot diggity dogs.
And our president and CEO of the Heifetz Institute, Justin Reiter, he bought a home in Stanton. He's moved down here. Our offices have moved down here. The rest of our staff is here. Justin, in 1 year, has become part of this community. The Rotary Club, other organizations, it's just truly fantastic.
I have a hard question for you. We all, at some point, shuffle off this mortal coil and have a tombstone. If you had to put one thing on your tombstone, would it be violinist or would it be international, the Heifetz Institute?
You know, it's funny. This will sound crazy, but I've told my wife, what I want on my tombstone is simply, he tried. That's it. He tried.
That makes me want to hug you. I have plenty. Is there anything else, Dad?
Just that my wife and I are truly in love with Stanton, the community, and that my mission is to change the paradigm in the classical music world and to open it up to popular culture, to realize the impact it can have, the impact that it had on the prisoners, to understand that impact can be throughout society. And the one little thing that I'll tell you also happened beginning my career is that I played in a Quaker meeting, my violin, and a woman stood up after I played a piece, the same Jewish piece I played in this prison. She said, "Mr. Heifetz, while you were playing," and this was while I was a student at Curtis, "while you were playing, a fire engine had gone down the street, and I thought about the, you know, fire that destroys, but when I heard your music, I felt that I was in touch with the fire that heals." And this was before I even started playing concerts, being an awareness of what this could mean in people's lives, if it is shared with that kind of a sense of communication.
It sounds to me as though you are intent on really sharing yourself.
So that's what it's all about.
Not just your talent.
That's what it's all about. It's who you are as a person.